I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to a Christmas edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. It truly is the best time of the year, and we'll be celebrating by doing our annual Films of the Year. This is collated by all of the Curzon staff sending us in their top 10. Sam having to sit around with a lovely Excel spreadsheet and count it all up, and then we have the pleasure of talking about some wonderful films. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me in the room is the winner of Achievement in Receiving Positive Feedback for Questions from Paul Dano, Kelly Powell.
Hello. Oh, wow, what an honour. Thank you so much.
And the award for Best Borges-inspired short-form programme across Curzon, Bloomsbury and the Horse Hospital is Stephen Ryder.
Well
thank
done.
You, Jake.
Yours was the best.
Yeah,
thank you.
Fair.
Yeah, there were a lot of people going for that one.
There's only been one other ever. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And Sam Howlett.
Nominee.
Yeah.
Nominee. My Borges-inspired programme was terrible.
Yeah. It was a good race, though.
Yeah. Oh, guys, it's the end of the year. And we've had a good year chatting
about
films.
What a horrible year. Yeah.
No good Christmas movie to top it off. What's the Christmas movie?
I think it's Mary Poppins, isn't it?
Is it set at Christmas?
No, but it's got that Christmassy feeling.
Not a Christmas movie, though.
Maybe it's set at Christmas, though.
The Grinch came out this Christmas,
I think. The Grinch came out.
Christmas Chronicles?
Not a lot of fanfare. I don't know what Christmas Chronicles is.
Kurt Russell has Santa.
Netflix?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So, before we go into the collated Curzon Top 10, Sam, you've been doing a bit of chat in the office, haven't you? A
little bit of chat, yeah. So we're going to hear from four people from head office who are going to speak about film from their top 10 that didn't make the overall top 10. So these are just kind of some alternate favourites from head office. We're going to have Curzon programmer Lydia Penker talking about the documentary Three Identical Strangers. We're going to hear from the director of marketing, Kate Garover, who's speaking about Annihilation. Then we're going to hear from, also from marketing, Duncan Carson, who's talking about Little Scene British documentary Ireland. And finally, friend of the podcast, Ryan Hewitt, is talking about Game Night.
Right, okay.
All right, love it.
Wow.
Great.
So do enjoy these mini reviews.
I do, like, Ryan will pop up like every few months to do a guest on the pod, and it always brings something with him.
Can I just say, I've never heard or seen Ryan be so passionate and enthusiastic about something than when he's talking about Game Night.
Did he put it as his number one?
No, it was middle of his list, but he's so...
Number one was Blockers.
Yeah. He speaks about Blockers in this as well. And Tag. It's basically Ryan's roundup of studio comedies in 2018.
Oh, I love it.
Great.
Kate Garover, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So one film that jumped out of me from your top 10 was Annihilation. Can you tell us why and how Annihilation came to be in your top 10 of 2018?
Annihilation, I think, took me somewhat by surprise. So I remember seeing an image from the film, and it's Natalie Portman, and she's looking into the mouth of like a, what could be a huge alligator. And that picture was sort of doing the rounds of our most anticipated films for 2018. And I was like, what is this film? I don't know what this film. I had no idea about the books at that time. And I do like sci-fi, and I'm a big fan of women in sci-fi, because I'm sure, Sam, you'd agree with me that there's not enough of them.
I do agree with you.
Okay. So, and then Paramount were due to release the film, and then Paramount weren't going to release the film. Netflix had the film. And so there was one afternoon, and I was sick, and I was off work, and so I thought, I'll watch Annihilation. And I just found it mesmerizing. I found it haunting. I didn't understand it. I still don't understand it all. I don't know if you know the story. Well, you've seen it, so you know the story. So Natalie Portman plays a biologist. And that's believable. You know, there are some Hollywood actors that couldn't play biologists, but I did definitely believe that she was one. Her husband goes on this mission, played by Oscar Isaac. He goes missing and she's grieving. And he returns unexpectedly, just comes back into their house. It's very clear quite quickly that he's not the same man that went on the mission, and before we know it, the sort of, you know, kind of government seemed to have swooped down, and he's hospitalized, and she starts to find out more about the mission that he went on. And basically there's something called the Shimmer, which is occurring over a sort of southern part of America, and strange things happen in the Shimmer. And then so Natalie Portman as the biologist goes off to explore with a set of other female scientists, including Jennifer Jason Leigh as the lead. And I just want to say that she's called Dr. Ventress, and nobody at all in any media that I see have seen seems to have picked up on the fact that Ventress is also the name of the assassin in the Clone Wars. Is it just me? Is that the, anyway,
The white head with that.
Yeah.
I haven't picked up on that.
I don't know if that means anything. And anyway, so they go into the Shimmer, and they find various strange botanical things happening, and creatures have also sort of, I don't know, gestated into something else, which hence the alligator picture. Anyway, I'm not going to give away the ending. So I have, since watching the film, directed by Alex Garland, went on and looked at a lot of kind of geek websites to see if I could make more sense of this film. It maybe makes slightly more sense of the film, but actually I don't think it matters that much. Because it is really, there's some beautiful scenes in there, imagery, and whilst you're watching it and you don't know what's going to happen, you have this sense of genuinely not knowing what's going to happen. And that's quite strange in a film, I think, these days. And I know sci-fi is always unusual and it's plotted out in that way, but I think that it is quite rare to really genuinely... I didn't know who was, or if anyone was going to survive by the end of it, any of those things. And after watching the film, I then went and read all three books.
All three? Does all this three. Film condense the three into one, or...
It does, yes, I suppose it does. I mean, I can say that the books are leave you with the same sense of dread in the pit of your stomach. So they are really amazing. Yeah. And but they do all have to be read, because it is sort of condensed. But obviously, clearly, with three books into one film, there is so much that's missed out that is creepy, and like your mind can't quite make sense of it. And it is, and I think that those are really extraordinary sort of senses of emotion to get from both mediums.
Yeah, definitely. I think the bit that I remember most was the bit with the bear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you say, it's like the image of the bear and the sound the bear makes happening at the same time.
Yep.
It takes your brain a second to work out what that is and then realize how horrible that is.
It's really horrible.
Yeah.
And then also, because at the point that you see the bear, you don't know exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
So your brain or your imagination is really working overtime to try and make sense of it.
Yeah, I think it's a really good sci-fi horror as well as a sort of standard sci-fi.
Yes.
And kind of people have compared it to kind of Tarkovsky.
Yes, and apparently, because I was listening, strangely, even though I didn't know you were going to ask me to speak about Annihilation, a podcast with Alex Garland, and he does reference Tarkovsky as one of his inspirations. So, yeah, that's true.
Something kind of arrivally in the way that it's sort of mid-budget sci-fi with a brain.
Yes, and that's apparently why Paramount didn't release it, because audiences found it, apparently test audiences found it too intellectual and too complicated.
Which it is. Yeah. Not too, but it is intellectual and it is complicated.
It is, and it's still kind of quite hard, I think, to even digest what you think it is, which we're not going to say here and now for people who haven't seen it. But what it does so well is it gets into your skin, which is a really, I think, an intriguing way of saying something about this film once you've seen it. and it does really make you sort of think, and it makes you think about things in the universe. So it makes you think about big themes in the universe. It makes you think about kind of rebirth and what it means to be authentic and you and true and, you know, and all the stories and that go beyond that, and the unknown and mystery, and they're quite a lot of things to have going on in your brain at exactly the same time.
But also, there isn't the film isn't just that; it's also an entertaining sci-fi film.
It's a great sci-fi film, and there are really, as well as all those themes, like I say, some of the haunting images, like when one of the scientists gets very close to nature and you see it growing around her. Mm. That's a really beautiful scene, and she also kind of makes a decision then, a quite a brave decision. And so I was really kind of swept away by the imagery as well. Yeah. So it is entertaining, very good. You know, very good kind of talented ensemble cast working together. And I don't think genre comes into it. I mean, gender rather comes into it. I just think it is refreshing to see these. I think it's refreshing to see these actors and you don't quite know how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you might see a kind of horror sci-fi and you'll see the... You'll see kind of people tropes of characteristics, whereas none of these, you know, none of these scientists have that.
Definitely.
Or these females have it. So you don't know who's going to potentially get, you know.
And it's not part of the plot that it's four women.
No.
They just are four women.
They just are.
Yeah. Indeed. But you've really made me want to rewatch it now.
Good.
So, Kate Grover, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lydia Penker, welcome to the Curzon Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're talking about some of your favourite films of the year, in particular, a documentary that hasn't appeared on any other list. So do you want to tell us about that one?
Yes, I was lucky enough to pick a film that no one in Curzon has either seen or heard about. It's called Three Identical Strangers, released by Dog Wolf, and it's a documentary about three identical strangers. It's quite hard to talk about this film without giving away massive spoiler alerts, but I think it's safe to say that in the first 10 minutes there's a lot of... It happens very quickly and you're just so amazed by what's unravelling in the first 10 minutes that you're like, how are they going to fill the next hour and a half of this film? And so it starts off with a guy going to university and people are going up to him, clapping him on the back, going, oh, hi, welcome back. And he's like, but I've never been here before. And then it turns out that he discovers he has an identical twin that was at the same university but dropped out.
Wow.
Then it unravels, yes.
It's one of these kind of stranger than fiction sort of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all true. And then obviously, that's not giving much away if I say that there's a third twin that enters into it. So a triplet rather than a twin.
Yeah.
And these guys are identical and they discovered they've had completely separate lives for all their lives. And then they hang out and become brothers, but they've all had very, very different upbringings. And it's just, the film is just so, it explores interesting avenues, like is it nature versus nurture, because they've had such different upbringings and they're different characters. And, but obviously there's a lot of media attention around them and they go on TV shows and they become instant celebrities and things like that.
So what was it about this film then that made it into your top 10?
I think it's because it was so unusual, and also because I was really happy that Netflix didn't take it and make it into a 10-part series, which it could easily have been, because there was so much material on it. And also because I hadn't heard anything about this story, and it must be really hard in this day and age to find stories that haven't really been unraveled. Mm. It probably did come out at the time, obviously it did, because there was loads of media around it. But to make a documentary about a story that's so old now, and it still feels so relevant and shocking as well, because there are twists in it. Just when you think it couldn't get any worse, there's a massive twist.
Okay.
That came too much away.
I think documentaries often sometimes get slightly ignored at the end of the year for these top 10 lists. Like, as we've seen with the Curzon top 10, most of them are fiction films. But, I mean, you picked two documentaries, didn't you?
I did, actually, yeah. I quite like to try and broaden out my list. Yeah. And I do think about, you know, there's the odd blockbuster in there. There's always something quite quirky in there, because that's actually the sort of film that I love, like The Greasy Strangler.
Yeah,
But maybe it's because we're not showing that many documentaries anymore than we used to.
So. Well, they're all on Netflix now, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
apart from this one, which is great.
Great. Lydia, thank you very much. Ryan Hewitt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Looking at your list, you've got a few that have cropped up time and time again on our list for this year, but there's one jumping out at me that I haven't seen on another list, and that is Game Night. So you can tell us a bit about what Game Night is and how it ended up in your top 10.
Well, Game Night is, for my money, the best studio comedy of the year. Mm-hmm. And it has had some stiff competition, let's be honest. Yeah. There's been Blockers as well. Yeah. Don't know if you caught that one.
I heard very good things about it.
Well, you know what? That's a surprisingly progressive film in terms of gender politics. Okay. You wouldn't think it.
No.
Given the setup.
Yeah.
It's an odious idea, really.
I saw the trailer and odious is a good word for what I thought about the trailer. But
do you know what? Give it a chance. Yeah. It's got an extraordinarily good set piece involving some blindfolded naked people in their house. I'll say no more, but it's terrific.
Okay.
And then there was Tag.
Yeah,
Tag.
I didn't see it, but I know that Jeremy Renner's arm was CGI'd because he broke his arm.
Did he?
For a couple of scenes, he's got a CGI arm.
Oh, I didn't know.
His arm was in a cast for parts of it.
I mean, that's a testament to how much I was... I wasn't laughing that much in Tag, to be honest. Tag has got some very ill-judged jokes throughout it. But it's all right.
Yeah.
It's all right. But the best, the cream of the crop, is absolutely Game Night.
Okay.
It's a story about a set of couples who are best friends, you know, like couple dates, that kind of thing, and they have a weekly game night. Mm-hmm. Every week they get around someone's house, they break out a board game, Pictionary, Scrabble, that kind of thing, charades, and they just compete in their couples.
Yeah.
It's very good natured. A couple of them get a bit competitive, but it's all fun and games.
Yeah.
And then one day, our lead is Jason Bateman, really. It's quite an ensemble, but really it's Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams are the lead couple. They're particularly good at games, they're very compatible with each other. And Jason Bateman's character has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder because his brother, played by Kyle Chandler, is considerably more successful and dashing and altogether cooler than him.
Okay.
He shows up after a bit of a period of being fairly estranged, joins in with Game Night, and then challenges them to an ultimate Game Night.
Right.
Which is a bit like that David Fincher film, The Game, where it's a big role-playing game. You don't know what's real, what's not. Things are going to get dangerous. It's like David Fincher's The Game, but it's not a bit boring. It's really funny. It's like really, really funny. Mm. And so Kyle Chandler's character, he sets this thing up. They all go around his house. The role play begins.
Yeah.
And it's not a role play. It's happening for real. He's being kidnapped. And the conceit is these guys, the rest of them, they have to work together to find the brother in order to save him from certain death. But they think it's just so they can win a car at the end.
Okay.
So the beauty of this film is the dramatic irony throughout of the audience knowing this is real and everybody else refusing to accept that it's real. And Jason Bateman is on absolutely perfect, his best form of playing that deadpan, totally self-aware. Yeah. Oh, this is ridiculous. There are little stupid scenes where like Kyle Chandler's getting beaten up in front of them, being kidnapped, and Jason Bateman's just going, guys, have you had this cheese? Oh, this cheese is delicious. Just picking up this cheese. And there's some really terrific moments where you know that they're hold, like things like, you know, they're holding a real gun, they've not figured it out. It's all so, so simple and so silly.
Yeah.
But that is where its brilliance lies. It is just completely, complete buffoonery the whole time. Everyone plays it so perfectly. And the moments of the reveals are kind of catch you off guard because it's so silly that you sort of think you should be able to keep up with this. And I'm maybe doing myself a disservice admitting that I got
okay.
a few times in this film. But I was just too busy laughing.
Yeah.
Bateman is just, he's doing his Arrested Development shtick times 10, really playing for the laughs, really doing this like put upon everyman thing. And Rachel McAdams is fantastic in comedy. She hasn't been this good since Mean Girls. I mean, you know, with respect to her dramatic roles, which are a different kind of fish, but she's really, really funny. Then there's this performance from Jesse Plemons, who plays a kind of, he's this like weird cop who lives next door to them. He used to be part of the gang. They've pushed him out because they think he's on oddball. Right. And he is odd, but he plays a crucial role. I would get into spoiler territory if I said any more. Sharon Horgan shows up. She's great. Everyone's just on really top form. And it pushes all of its gags to the absolute limit without them being just bad taste. They're so close to bad taste.
Right.
But the guys who've written it and directed it, who, if I'm not mistaken, they have credits on Spider-Man Homecoming and
I think they do.
A couple of other fairly respectable films. They pull it back at just the right point. So this is where Tag went wrong, for example. It didn't pull them back far enough. It went too far with things and it just became bad taste. But Game Night just lands perfectly. I've read a lot of reviews. People are a little bit snooty about it. They're quite happy to admit that it's amusing, which is like, come on, guys. It's really funny.
Yeah.
It's really funny. And it has these like thriller elements, but they're all in service of jokes. It's not a thriller. It is a like straight up comedy. studio comedy that rarely work. It's 96 minutes long. When was the last time there was a studio comedy that wasn't over 2 hours long and had to have 30 minutes with someone learning a life lesson? Like, thank God we've moved past that. That was, you know, that Apatow thing was great for a time, but we're past it. I can't do another train wreck or another one of these things. It just goes on and on and on. This one is just efficient, no messing about, just, well, pure messing about, but does what it does.
Yeah.
It's great fun.
Nice one. Cheers, Ryan. Thanks. Cheers, dude. Duncan Carson, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're here to talk about one of your top 10 films of the year, and that is The Island. So what is it, and why is it in your top 10?
So Island is a very small British documentary. Didn't actually play that many sites. But I want to talk about this film because I think I was the only one in the entire company. Hopefully I wasn't the only one who saw it, but I'm certainly the only one who put it in their top 10 in the year. And as much as there are other films that, you know, I thought were maybe more cinematically lasting, it was the film that I thought about the most this year and it had the most unique experience. And when I tell you it's about, it's basically about people dying for 90 minutes, and it's a film set in a hospice in the Isle of Wight, and it's very artistic, it's very abstract from time to time, and it basically follows four people as they're facing the end, and obviously it has that straight, the finale is no surprise to anyone, because it is about death, and it had a degree of notoriety because it was one of the first films to show someone's last moments as a kind of a really mesmerizing kind of 8 or so minute shot of one of the characters breathing their last, and then the subsequent moments when the hospice nurses deal with him afterwards. So I find that incredibly moving. I think it's a really hard thing to face, death, but I think it shows you that people face it in a lot of different ways. You're as unique as, you know, your approach to death is as unique as you are. There's a sort of like, kind of like folk philosopher guy who's, you know, gives his sort of like views about existentialism, kind of like eschatology and, you know, where it's all going. And that's fascinating. and there's an older woman who clearly just wants some level of contact. There's a guy in middle age who's terminally ill, who's saying goodbye, you know, far before his time. And, you know, he's completely conscious about what's going on, how, you know, his friend's visiting him. And it's really poignant and heartbreaking and moving. But I think we could all stand, given how much time we spend avoiding thinking about death, we could all stand to be in the experience of death a little bit more and sort of humanize it and fear it a little bit less. That's why I thought it was really unique experience.
Yeah. How does this sort of compare to other documentaries? Like, what sort of style documentary is it? How?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's one of those, you know, I felt really relieved that I could see it in the context of with the director, because I think it raises a lot of ethical questions, because, you know, it's very intimate. You know, we're not normally showing these things on screen, and it raises a lot of questions where you're like, is it okay that I'm looking at this? Have they been okay to look at this? And I know, you know, there's ways that the film subtly attunes to the fact that you know, that this is a sort of like conversation between the filmmakers, that, you know, that Stephen Eastwood, the director, is sort of directly addressed on camera, but then he was on hand to sort of like confirm a lot of the things. So he actually, you know, went to a crazy extent of becoming the next of kin of the man you see die on screen, because the only way you can kind of be alerted that someone's reaching the end is if you become a next of kin, and he didn't have any other people in his life. So that was pretty astonishing to hear that. So I think it's a much more intimate documentary, and as much as it's not kind of like a Michael Moore sort of Louis Theroux type, you know, like person on, you know, on screen, yeah, interviewing people, but it hasn't, like, you know, you're aware of there being a presence, but not, you know, like a controlling hand. It doesn't feel authored. He's just giving, it's more like you're aware of a conversation happening that at least one person's right, not speaking, but they're, you know, they're a presence as the director. Okay.
Thank you, Duncan. Cheers, sir.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, so coming in at number 10 and really making us all look great is a film called Summer 1993, which none of us have seen.
Nope.
Sam, what is this one?
This is a Italian coming-of-age drama, and not loads of people put it in their list, but the ones that did put it very highly.
So that's how it's in the algorithm.
The algorithm, so you get 1 point for a film at number 10, 2 points at 9, 3 points at 8, etc., etc. And so you get the number one film of each list gets 10 points. Mm. And this appeared in enough people's lists in a higher section that it got enough points just to sneak in at the end.
Lovely. And that is actually available on Curzon Home Cinema, so we've got no excuses.
I remember seeing it played at Bloomsbury for quite a while, and I think it did kind of have a really steady audience to it. It's definitely a film that went under my radar, so I'll be catching it.
Excellent. Well, number nine is one of my favourites. It's Lady Bird. And I know this was a pretty special interview because we managed to get Greta Gerwig on the podcast. And yeah, I love Lady Bird. It's hella tight. but I don't know what the feeling in the room is for Lady Bird. Yeah. It's a bit slight, and maybe in like 9 months later.
Yeah,
it
feels like I forgot even that it was released this year. Mm. But yeah, definitely when it was out and when it was peaking, I was on that train.
Yeah.
So I really I forgot about it actually, but it didn't. Unfortunately, didn't make my top 10 of the year, just because I think so many great films came out since. But yeah, I actually want to go back and watch it again.
Me too. Yeah, me too. I feel like it's a film that feels like it's got a lot to give over kind of a longer watching period. I, I,
I'm not sure if it's at the time when it came out, it seemed quite, it seemed to tap into something that people were really needing in cinema at that point of the year. And I think that that Greta Gerwig's nomination, she got a nomination for Best Director, I think, that year, kind of really spurred people on, spurred the box office, spurred people to go and see it. Personally, I don't think the direction in the film was actually that impressive. I do think that, her direction of actors was very, very, very good. And the writing was such an amazing script from top to bottom. So, yeah, I think Lady Bird, I'd be really interested to see if it stands the test of time, actually. But I'm just looking forward to her, to Little Women, to be honest, in that cast. Yeah. So it seems like, from what I've said about her being a good director with actors, I think that's what, probably why she's secured such an incredible cast for Little Women. So.
Yeah. And also there's a cut in a car between Saoirse Ronan's character and the mum. And that is, for me, is the best edit of the year. Yeah, it's so good. And speaking of fantastically edited films, let's go on to 120 BPM. This is another kind of holdover from 2017 as well. But this is terrific, isn't it?
This is terrific, yeah. And we had director Robin Campillo on the show. Phil was like 2 years ago now, but it was like 9 months ago. Yeah, really important film. And not as heavy as you'd think it might be.
Yeah, well, heavy, but it's that not was the tough sell, it's like very, the 2.5 hour long
AIDS activist film. It's a tough sell, but I think you're right. The editing, the cinematography, the acting, everything kind of brings it together and gives it this energy that means you really don't feel weighed down by it.
No, it has this amazing ability to completely make time elastic.
Yeah.
There is like conversation about an early sex act in one of the characters' life that's phenomenal.
It's the best scene in the film for me. Yeah.
And the way that it moves from these protest-based conversations in a lecture theatre into a club, into these CGI bits of kind of blood cells, and it's so well cut that you don't even notice these huge changes of the aesthetic.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I think that that extended bedroom scene is actually a really good example of that. Like the fact that it's a post-sex scene, which isn't something we get to see very often in cinema. One that where the discussion post-sex is actually longer than the sex itself. And that's, I think, that's part of that time elasticity is that, you know, we don't cut. And that's what a film like this needs, is less cutting away from actual conversation about, you know, the issues that these people are going through. And I think it's an incredible film. And I it's been long enough to revisit it, I think, since I've seen it. So, absolutely.
And amazing remix of Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat in there.
Yeah.
Right. And this was actually another one that was part of the incredible early year artificial eye run of a kind of Fantastic Woman BPM and The Square. So Fantastic Woman, we've just spoken about Disobedience, Sebastian Lelio's film. This was the film that won the foreign language Oscar that he made prior to Disobedience.
I think this film really, you know, captured something in people that they really, really got on with it. People really love this film that I've spoken to. And yeah, Sebastian Lelio, what a crazy year to have Disobedience, Fantastic Woman, and then next year, Gloria Bell come out.
Well, that's already premiered.
Yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah, he's a worker,
busy boy.
Isn't he? We were talking about this though, Kelly, weren't we? Yeah, he's taking these projects on kind of thick and fast. You almost want him to slow down a little bit.
Yeah.
But as long as he's putting out quality work, you know, that's what matters.
Yeah. The more memorable bits for a Fantastic Woman for me were those kind of magic realist touches, which I didn't know were going to happen in there. And just when the wind machine suddenly turns up to 100 just to walk down the street. And maybe in another director's hands, that would be a flourish that feels over the top and just kind of leaning into hard into the melodrama of the story. Mm. But actually, I think it totally works. Okay, up next at number 6 is Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which is probably the most recent film that we spoke about on the podcast.
Yeah, I can't believe it's only at number 6.
Yeah, I thought it would be higher as well, but I think maybe this is a release date problem. People saw it maybe quite late.
So what?
Well, I don't know, like the films that are higher in there, they've maybe had a longer time to sink in and to...
Maybe. I mean, I just don't know how you don't see that movie and go, this is probably one of the best movies ever like made in the last decade.
I think maybe it's the fact that it's quite a complex film. And I think people are still processing it right now.
Maybe.
And there's a lot of discussions that are happening right now about kind of whose story is it to tell, and kind of class portrayal. And maybe, not that I loved it personally, I thought it was a fantastic film, but like I think people are still wrapping their heads around what Roma is and where it fits in the canon of 2018, and also kind of where it's going to fit in the canon of Cuarón's career. I think Sam's right. I think it's a release date kind of longevity issue. We've sat with Phantom Thread and we've sat with like things like that for a year now, so we're still waiting to see kind of how people take in Roma in the mainstream in a wider audience.
Man, it's almost like this conversation about release dates gets really annoying every year.
But I think it's a good thing. I think Roma's is going to stand the test of time.
Oh yeah, 100%.
We should actually say that the rules for this list were that they had to play to a public audience.
Yes,
a UK public audience in 2018.
Yeah,
so
America, which I think is fair.
That's a yeah. I agree. Kelly, Roma's your number one film, is it?
Yeah,
not?
Yeah, it's definitely
of all time.
I don't know about that, but definitely of this year.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was my number two, but I think it is very, very good.
I only saw it in the last couple of days.
I think it could do Best Picture.
Yeah,
it probably should. Yeah, like, to
I
be
think
honest.
It definitely should. Yeah, I think it maybe will. I think it's our Moonlight this year.
I'm ready to see how it plays on Netflix though. Because I've only seen
No one will ever know.
No one will ever know.
Right, number five. I know that Stephen Moroder, you're a big fan of this one. Loveless.
We're talking Loveless.
Yeah,
I love Loveless. No, I've seen Loveless. I've seen Loveless a few times now, and I'm really glad to see it on the list actually, because that's it could be a film that was easily forgotten, but it's unlike any film that I've seen in cinema since. I think it's just drained of any compassion for long portions of the film, both as a director. Zvagnitsev, I think is how you pronounce his name, as a director, and the actors are just drained of any compassion. We get this incredible performance from the young child at the start of the film, and then he's pulled out of the movie. It's incredible. And I think that the way that it's shot with so much focus on like nature, but are completely void of any leaves or flowers or colour, is a really, really nice visual representation of what's going on in Russia and in these characters' lives at the time. It's an absolutely fantastic movie. It really is.
There's a lot of snow, so very much a Christmas film, isn't it?
Yeah.
One to get the family.
the most Christmassy film we've spoke about.
It's just like a family coming together.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But no, then about the compassion, there is an explosion of it at the end of the film.
There's an explosion?
An explosion of compassion.
This film is awesome. Yeah.
That kind of like, yeah, that really takes you by surprise, makes you question what you've seen previously. So yeah, I'm really glad to see Loveless on the list.
Excellent. Okay, we're going to move on now to the only joint position in our top 10 with exactly the same number of votes, and therefore they can both say that they came third, both standing on the podium.
That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that.
Everyone's a winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. Bloody love that.
That is Shoplifters and You Were Never Really Here. Oh, that's a good double.
That's a really good double
bill. Yeah. We talked about Shoplifters a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and what I was thinking about this today on my way here, because I knew it would come up in the top 10, and I just think what's not being talked about a lot with Shoplifters is that kind of final portion of the film, where I think that Coriader's films, we talked about family on that podcast and how he makes films about unconventional families, but what I don't think we touched on altogether was that in a way it's a very 2018 film, in that there's a big media storm at the end of it, and a lot of what happens to these characters is in post, you know, inciting event in the film, is that the media controls their destiny and controls how people perceive them. And I think that Coriader could just as easily be making a statement on how careful and how critical we've got to be of what we see in the media, because we spend so much of the film with this family, this incredible family who've come together in a multitude of ways to be unconventional, and we come out of it with this kind of love for them, this compassion for them. And then it's all taken away from us by the media. And I think that Coriader is making a really interesting, insightful statement on that.
Well, and you were saying on that episode that his films just are so underlined with this quietly damning message that he's never shouting about as well. But it's just so rewarding to just go back, revisit, rewatch, and just see what else is going along in this film that is initially just so gentle.
Yeah, there's an amazing undercurrent all the way through the film, just kind of like slowly drags you along. It's a beautiful film. Have you seen it yet, Kelly?
Yeah, I was on the podcast. Yeah.
Oh, were you?
Rude.
No, did it get into your top 10?
It didn't, but I don't know why. Yeah, it's just one of those where I think I'm going to be revisiting many times.
Yeah, it's well worth it.
Yeah, totally. I think, I don't know why I didn't make my top 10, but I did really love that film.
Maybe it's because you did it this morning on the bus.
Yeah. And, Campbell, who was the guest on that episode of the podcast, did an interview with Hirokazu Koreeda, and that's up on the blog if anyone wants to check that out. And joining Shoplifters in third place is Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here.
Really good.
Amazing film. I saw it at LFF last year, so it's been in my brain for quite a while now. And it stayed with me for that amount of time, and it's going to stay with me forever, I think. I watched it again recently on the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray design, by the way, is lovely.
Mm.
It's a black case, and it's got like the arm, which turns into like a blood trickle. And then walking in the middle. That's really
nice.
Cool.
There was a lot of great alternate artwork.
But it's such a cool film, and it's so like
he's just such a cool guy.
Just like really cool.
Really cool.
The way that he kills people.
I do love just wicked.
Yeah, trauma is cool.
Yeah. Trauma is cool.
super cool guy.
It's like this
he's
complex.
Like, he's like Tom Cruise in Collateral. He's just a dude, isn't he?
I think it's cool, I think it's stylish. And
Sam's right, it is very cool.
And it
distracts you from
how horrible everyone is and
how
awful the world is.
And Joaquin Phoenix's character is not okay.
No, it's a film about child abuse, it's a film about trauma, you know, it's a film about not being able to escape the cycle of violence that the world's kind of perpetuating at the moment. But you do come out of it like, jeez, Lynn Ramsey's a great director.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's incredible.
You know, you come out of it just thinking how good she is and how much she deserves as much budget as she needs to make movies.
And she's amazing. It's just the right amount of directed, if that makes sense. Like, you're aware that the film is being like directed and filmed and like constructed, but it's not distracting.
It's like a show, it's incredible.
Exactly. Like, it's a complex thriller with all the complexity removed.
Best opening titles of the year for me as well.
Yeah.
I always go on about editing and these things, and I have done already today, but You Were Never Really Here. If you were teaching editing, I think, to someone, this is what you'd show them. Like, this is absolutely the essential elements to tell a story and nothing more.
She's so good at that in general.
I watched, one of my favourite experiences in the cinema this year was being able to see Morven Keller on the big screen. Oh. And again, remarkable stuff. Mm. She is so good. And she spoke about in the interview that like the editing on this wasn't like in some editing studio here in Soho or something. It was like her and her editor at his flat, and like Johnny Greenwood would just like email them audio files and just like drag and drop them in just to play around. It was just like everything about it seems like it was just done.
Yeah,
like she's on nothing.
To me, it feels like she's taking a lot of influence from Nick Rogue, who unfortunately passed away this year, in the way that she edits. With sound, primarily, is that what Ramsey does is she doesn't just take visuals and edit them into an inappropriate order to kind of confuse you. She takes sound from one scene to the other to make it quiet. It's quite disorientating, but in a way that makes sense to the viewer. It's not just disorientating for disorientating's sake. It's telling a story with the editing, with the sound design, across multiple edits. And it's so clever. It's such a clever film.
All right. In second place is one of the biggest foreign language success at the UK box office this year. And as we revealed on our European Film Awards podcast last week, a five-time European Film Award winner now is Pavel Pavlikovsky's Cold War.
Mm.
Yeah. And again, something that's really captured something in people.
Totally. Yeah. It feels like people went mental for this film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really good film. I don't know if it's that high on my list, but it's, it seems like people just remember this film and have been, like, grabbed it and dragged along with it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they just loved it. And for good reason. I mean, there's some scenes in there that I think are absolutely exquisite. Like, and the way that he tells a story, as well, the editing is also that elliptical editing.
European Film Award winner.
Yeah, exactly.
For editing,
It's
that deserved.
Of course. And he's just an exciting filmmaker to follow. But yeah, that scene in the hall, you know, when they're doing the it's just a whole scene told full of looks, and the mirrors and the reflections, and that from that scene on, I was like totally sold. I was like, yeah, this film is.
He has a habit of opening a scene with just such a striking shot that you have to kind of figure out.
Yeah.
You look at it and you're like, okay, what am I looking at here? How much is this a close-up? Is it a kind of long shot? Where are the reflections happening in this room? And I think he's so good at making an audience stay in touch with the film for the entire running time through visuals. He's an incredibly striking director, and that's what I like about him. And probably one of the reasons it did so well at the box office, apart from me constantly telling people to see things on the big screen, is that it's a big screen film. You look at a venue like Curzon Mayfair, and that film's just going to play on that. Yeah, film, you know,
and it's so short.
That's
you can fit like 10 screenings
exactly,
in a day.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also an example that, like, you know, great art house films do not need to be 3.5 hours long.
They do, and they don't need to be...
Good shout, actually.
Yeah.
Really good
Thank
shout.
You.
They also don't need to be really complicated and overly intellectual and challenging. This is a very simple story told in a very simple way, under 90 minutes. Pretty much two major characters that have a troubled relationship, and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get to our number one film, I think it's maybe worth going around the table for just to fill in some honourable mentions from you guys. Stephen, anything that didn't make this complete top 10 that you'd love to shout about?
Well, I would actually, yeah. I would like to shout out a film called The Tale, which was actually, it did play in cinemas this year for a little while. The reason it didn't play for very long is because it was a HBO release. It's by a film director first time called Jennifer Fox, who's telling her own story in this film. I don't know if any of you guys have seen it.
Mm-mm. I know of it. It's Laura Dern.
It's Laura Dern, who for me gives the best performance of the year, as she usually does in any given year. It's about a child sexual abuse case, but told from a very personal point of view, about a woman kind of rediscovering her memories that she's repressed. And it's told in such a harrowing but clever way that makes you really empathize with the character. She's a really incredible, powerful performer, Laura Dern, that you can't quite figure out in any of her films. They're performances that you need to watch again and again and again. She loves playing very, very complicated characters that aren't necessarily good, and don't fall into the dichotomy of good or bad. And this is exactly the same. There's no kind of... She's a survivor that doesn't want to be called a survivor, and it makes you question, like, how, you know, victims of this kind of stuff move on with their lives. But if anyone can see The Tale, it will be on, I think, various streaming platforms at this point, but it's well
Imagine
worth checking out.
Sky Atlantic at some point as well, if it's HBO.
Yeah. All right, cool. Yeah, but it's well worth checking out, but it's not an easy watch. I will say it's a very, very difficult watch. More difficult, I think, than any film I've seen this year, including Gaspar Noé's Climax, which I loved.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie, I loved it.
Okay.
Is that all you can mention?
Oh, I can mention Climax. I think Climax is a great, a stunning achievement of the year. It's another Gaspar Noé film that has nothing to say whatsoever, but it'll take you into a hellscape and keep you there for a while and have you kind of circling the drain before it lets you out of the cinema. So it's well worth checking out.
Yeah, that is an accurate description of the Gaspar Noé. Kelly, have you got an honourable mention for us?
Yeah, difficult to choose because there's many that I think that were left off, but up there is Zama.
Oh yeah.
Which is a phenomenal film. The cinematography in that, I think, is going to stay with me for a very long time. And I really would like to see that again. And what else was Mandy? I absolutely loved Mandy.
Mandy's
really good.
I just think it's so good. Instant cult classic.
Scary! Evil!
Yes. Nick Cage, I think one of his best performances in the last decade.
I mean, he keeps knocking him out of the park for me. I've heard he's very good in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse as well as Spider-Man Noir.
Yeah. So, I really want to see that. That's going to be that's like on the
already in
end of the year.
Already in the IMDb top 20 films.
Yeah, it is.
Top 20
ever.
Yes. That will trickle down. That always happens with these.
I'm
like,
just saying, it's made it.
It's made it.
It's part of the canon now, guys.
It's the Snyder Cut.
And Burning, I think, is also on my list. Yeah.
Not released until next year.
Oh, okay. And
Save
then,
that one.
And Jeune Femme, I think, also is one that I really loved when it came out, and I watched it a couple of times.
Not a lovely film.
Yeah, really good. Really good film.
Yeah.
Alrighty, Sam.
Well, I got a couple that there's ones I'm surprised didn't get in there. So I thought Hereditary might have a bit more heft with people, but I think I was the only one that had it quite high on my list. First Reformed as well, I was surprised didn't really do much. But I mean, that's quite a hard film to watch and a hard film to like. So maybe that's why. I mean, I loved it.
It's so good.
Yeah, I think out of all the film, actually, I think out of all the films this year, top to bottom, I think that's the one that people are going to look back as being the most prescient film of our time.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
And I think people should try and see it as soon as possible for that very
reason. It's an amazing film. And I hope Ethan Hawke can carry this sort of wave of like, the Critics' Choice Awards to a Best Actor nomination.
Yeah.
I think he can.
Just the nod.
I think probably just the nod. I don't know, he could be a dark horse. Yeah. A Star is Born. I think I was the only person that had that on my list. From head office.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's on my list. I love that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stephen, you're shaking your head?
No, I'm not shaking my head. I think it's a good... I think the first hour deserves to be in the top 10 of any list, but I think it just falls apart like a cardboard box in the rain.
I loved its old-fashionedness. I loved its melodrama, and it's like a film like... sort of old-fashioned film with like star power that you don't really get anymore.
I kind of like that. I agree with all of those things. I just think it needs to tell a coherent
story. And
very quickly,
Avengers Infinity War made my top 10.
Really?
Yeah, it's number 10.
But that has a joint spot on your top 10 with Mission Impossible 4.
It does.
Which I think is the best blockbuster of the year. And that was my number 2 film.
Really?
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
It's a good choice.
Yeah. It's a quality film. Yeah. Just so well done. And I encourage everyone to find any audio interview with Chris McQuarrie that you can. He is such a great storyteller.
He is.
His episode of Soundtracking with Edith Bowman... with him and Lorne Balfe talking about the music of Fallout. It's about an hour long. They play music from that, from the original series, from the Brian De Palma film, all talking about how the music came together in Fallout. Mm. Such a good interview.
And Empire did a 4-hour interview with
him.
Turned
out to be seven.
Seven Jeez. Hours. Yeah. 7-hour interview with him.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't make me happy.
What?
He just speaks so well. Yeah,
it works.
It does. Yeah. I can't deny. All right, number one film of the year. We haven't got long left. We've spoken about it throughout the year. We even gave it its own episode. Of course, it's Phantom Thread.
Yeah, yeah, deservedly so.
Yeah, I mean, this was my number one.
It was my number one.
My number two.
I left it off my list because no. I loved it because I had it on last year's. I had it on last year's list.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah, I had it on that one. I didn't want to double down. I didn't want to double dip. Yeah.
But, did you see it last year?
Yeah, I think so. I think I saw it.
I thought we saw it at the same time.
That was early this year.
Really? Yeah, that was 2018.
Well, it's a great movie, guys.
Well, even without it going on your list, it's still number
one. I think it's a fantastic film, and it deserves to be number one on any list. Paul Thomas Anderson knocked it out of the park with this one.
So I believe this was number one by 12 points.
So, yeah.
Is that the biggest number one win ever?
I don't know. I can't have the answer for you on that one.
Right.
Well,
check the stats.
It doesn't matter how they scored, does it, Super?
Yeah.
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 No, it falls in wonderfully into the canon of deadly mushroom films that have been coming out recently, which is amazing. If you've been following that, I think Twitter's kind of keeping a tally of deadly mushroom films that are happening at the moment. Maybe we'll see that following into 2019.
I'm happy to see it as someone who doesn't like mushrooms. More of this, please.
Anti-mushroom propaganda.
Yes.
I think the trailer really left me wondering what the hell is this film going to be about? And I like to go into a Paul Thomas Anderson film pretty cold, and I left it really thinking, I didn't think it was going to be like that.
Mm.
Like a romance comedy?
Mm.
And it is really funny and really romantic, but also a lot of other stuff going on as well.
And it spawned a good many memes.
Good many memes.
The No Context Phantom Thread Twitter account is always reliable in any situation.
So quotable.
Yeah.
I think it's just great that we've got someone like Vicky Creeps to come out of it as well.
Oh, yeah.
A new star in my eyes. Like,
Star is born.
It's a shame she hasn't had another film that's...
Tell me something!
It's a shame that she's not had something else come out this year already. I can't wait to see what she's going to be in next. Incredible actress. And held her own against Daniel Day-Lewis, which is the most impressive.
I think she's doing Bergman Island.
Yes.
With Mia Hansen-Love.
Yep.
I'm very excited about that. Greta Gerwig left the project and she's come in as a replacement. I mean, in terms of replacements for Greta Gerwig, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Congratulations to Phantom Thread. Before we go, I've got a game for you guys as it's Christmas. I've got a little quiz. The winner will be receiving a Blu-ray and digital copy of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
I don't want to play this game.
No, I want that.
Just in case I win.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really want that.
I saw that in the cinema with the worst hangover ever.
Tim Burton's your favourite director, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, it was when I was like 10.
So, guys, I've got some... it's a game called Sequel or Noquel. So these are Christmas sequels. You have to tell me whether or not they exist. It is a buzzer-based game. All right, okay. So you've got to call in, and you have to tell me whether this film exists. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure.
I think that doesn't exist.
Minus 1 point.
Damn it.
You've got to play it safe, Stephen. You can't just be...
Wait, I didn't think there were no rules that were like, if you get it wrong.
Yeah, I didn't know that was going to happen.
I'm glad I didn't. It's almost like I'm making it up as I go along.
Now I know.
All right.
Minus one, that's shocking.
Yeah. This embarrassing. Is how you get 15 minutes of silence on a podcast because everyone's too scared to answer.
All right.
God, I want that Blu-ray.
Film number two. Home Alone 4, Taking Back the House.
Buzz, it exists.
It does exist. Plus 1 point. There is a bonus. 2 points now available if anyone can tell me what director Peter Hewitt's debut feature film was.
I've never heard of that person.
Oh, there are too many films for me to do a guess.
Name a film.
Christmas film.
Hang on, Peter Hewitt.
His debut film.
What was his other film?
Yeah. Yeah, give me one of his other films.
Well, Home Alone 4, Taking Back the House.
So his debut film would have been...
Before Home Alone 4 came out, which we all know was...
Could it have been Home Alone 3?
It was not. Minus 1 point. Peter Hewitt's debut feature film was Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Oh.
Okay, Bad Santa 2.
Buzz, it exists.
It does. Plus two over here. Oh, come on, guys. Kelly.
Yeah.
Step it up.
I don't know anything about Christmas films, guys. I'm Jewish.
Any Hanukkah films in this list whatsoever.
Eight Crazy Nights.
The Holiday 2, Island Getaway.
That exists, I think.
Minus 1 point. Does not exist.
Oh, the other side of the table.
I wish it did.
Shocking.
Yeah. Home Alone 6, Kevin's Sacrifice.
Definitely does not exist.
He's got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to minus one. Wonderful. Yeah.
The minus one is over here.
Kevin's Sacrifice.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, The Return of Borax.
Buzz, it does exist.
It doesn't.
Oh.
All the playing field.
Borax is in Futurama, isn't it?
I have seen Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, the original, though. Not a good Christmas film.
Really?
Don't search it out. It's bad.
Okay.
Jingle All the Way 2.
Definitely exists.
It does.
Yeah.
Steven's pulling it back.
Yeah. I'm on zero. All right.
What are the scores?
I'm on zero. You're on one. You're on minus
one.
Okay. So I think it's only fair to say that the final film... is a 3-pointer.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
Miracle on 35th Street.
Buzz does not exist.
It doesn't exist.
Oh,
well done, Sam.
That was one of the things in the quiz last night.
Well, Miracle on 34th Street was, yeah. That's what makes
there
it.
There
you are,
Sam. There is
joke.
Your copy of wow. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children on Blu-ray and digital HD.
Oh, good.
Merry Christmas.
Well done. All right. Thank you so much for listening to the Curzon Film Podcast 2018. Not just this best of episode, but of course, throughout the year. It's been wonderful to have you with us. If you want some podcast dissection of the films we've been talking about, we have got episodes and interviews with people on Lady Bird, 120 BPM, A Fantastic Woman, Roma, Loveless, You Were Never Really Here, Shoplifters, Cold War, and Phantom Thread. We spoke about them all, so go back and listen to those episodes if you want to.
Quite a few of the top 10 are also on Curzon Home Cinema. We have a collection called Best of 2018 where quite a few of them reside.
And until 2019, I suppose that's it. We will be back with an episode on The Favourite and An Impossible Love, and I was lucky enough to speak to Mark Gatiss all about The Favourite.
Yeah, so An Impossible Love is in cinemas January 4th, but it will be on Curzon Home Cinema a week earlier on December 28th, so you can see it before anyone else in the UK, Curzon Home Cinema, December 28th.
Excellent. Right, so if people want to keep up with everyone's Christmas watching, Stephen, they can follow you on Letterboxd, can't you? Where you can find your personal list as well.
Yes, you can find my personal list on there, which includes not... doesn't go by Curzon's rules, that list. My own rules.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can find me on Hydra 815.
Lovely. And Kelly, people can keep up with you on Letterboxd as well.
Yeah, Kelly P-triple-E.
Lovely. And Sammy, you're posting mostly on Twitter. Or do you want to share your
Letterboxd? I'm trying to see what my username is on Letterboxd. Just find it through Kelly's. Yeah. It'll be like S Howlett something.
Yeah, nice.
And I'm on Twitter at SamHowlett_1.
Great. And I'm on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening again. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.